the Canadian poet. Mm-hmm. And I posted a video of him. You can see him in action in 1982, right when this date. But November 18th, 81. November 18th?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's Wyndham Lewis' birthday. So we went to a conference and in Toronto. I think Gene Youngblood, who did Expanded Cinema, was there. And maybe Barry Nevitt spoke. This is after McLuhan died in the last day of 1980. So we're now a year later. And it's a year... November 18th, 81. That's when I got the nod to do McLuhan's Archives.
Ooh.
So, I'm telling Mark Stewart and Barry Nevitt told Ms. McLuhan, get Bob if you want to organize Marshall's papers. As nobody knows Marshall as much as Bob. Get him to organize it. So, I'm telling Ian on November 18th, 1981, that I got this gig doing Marshall's papers. Wow! I get to see all whatever I thought I would find there. And you remember that place down by the Art College Carroll, the Grange, and they had a little mall there? And you might have been there. We were sitting there, it was a conference, and we were just eating in a cheap place, you know, cheap Subway place or something. And I'm telling you, and Ian freaked out. Maybe he got jealous. He got very mad at me for some stupid reason and stormed out.
Well, when you said it to me, when you just said it right there, it kind of sounded like people were vying for that position to be the one to go through.
No, nobody knew about it. I didn't know it. Nobody knew that. They didn't know anything. Nobody knew. Jeez, they're all dead. The Marshall died, but I don't think they were thinking, oh, I'm going to be the guy to do the papers. I don't think anybody, because I wasn't thinking about it. We didn't know what papers there were, and I was surprised. They called me up and nominated me. So right around that time, because I know I started working the last week, you know, the 22nd, 23rd of November is when I started doing it. We went to a bank building. In the top floor where all the filing cabinets were, where all the letters were in the filing cabinets. They wouldn't let me look at the letters, but I had organized all the boxes. There were about 60 cardboard boxes with papers and files all just scrambly dumped in there. And they might have been messy because some of them were at the coach house, and that was emptied out messily by people who didn't care about Marshall's work. So maybe that's why it was all mixed up. But I was the only one who would know, okay, here's an article. I can tell the style of writing. This would have been written in the 40s. So then I put it in a 1940s file. I could figure out where things, what years they would go to, what decades. So Mrs. McLuhan and their agent, Mady Molinaro, you can read about them in the letters of McLuhan. They get credits for putting that together with William Toy, who was a good friend of Dave Neufeld's father. And we know a little bit about behind the scenes of him writing that book with Mady and Corinne. So, Corinne McLuhan and Mady Molinaro. So I'm telling Ian about this, and he has a tantrum and walks out. And I don't see him for 3 years.
But you are not sure why, or you know it's because of that?
I think he was jealous.
That's what I was saying. I bet he's just jealous. I couldn't handle it.
He was always slightly jealous. I mean, years later, he's sitting in our nice home in the late 80s, and he brought a friend over and introduced him to me, but he's sitting there with his friend, and he looks at me and goes, you fucking lucky bastard. You fucking lucky bastard. He sort of saying this at me as we're sitting in our beautiful house, and he's living in a dingy place, you know. He's always semi-homeless. He made the mistake of going back to university and getting in huge debt. So you can go on Dupes and look at the video of him, because that video is about 81, 82. That's right when he got mad at me. He went to Ottawa and lived there for a few years. And then he got back in touch with me somehow, and then we became, quote, friends again. But he's someone I knew, and he came from Toronto and lived in Halifax in that 70s period. He was part of the people... He's not, and stories aren't made about him, but he's part of the stories in the Toronto section of the diary. He's one of them is named Ian, right? And, I think I make Nelson Ian, and I make Ian Nelson, totally opposites, you know. So, anyways, that's what happened on November 18th, 81. significant encounter with Ian, you know?
You think you made Nelson Ian and Ian Nelson, but can't be sure about that.
Well, I have to check it. I switched the names, but I think that's what I would have done, because Nelson is a, you know, rich kid, and Ian's a homeless poet from Burlington, and I have Ian here. If he ever read the diaries, he'd be reading himself as Nelson, which was a joke I did on him. And Nelson never wanted to be like Ian.
That's what I wanted to interject. You do this to make an intimate joke with the person that it's done to.
Yeah, it's an insider to them.
It's not to confuse people or to code things. It's just to kind of let them be in on it.
It's a personal joke only they'd get, because it doesn't matter to you that he's named Ian or Nelson. It doesn't mean anything.
Absolutely, but it could matter to me in a paranoid way where I could just all day long try to decode it.
I'm actually frustrating you. Yeah, that's a good point. I'm making a joke for you guys, because you're going to have to eventually decode it and realize, oh, this is the other guy. He switched the name. James Kidney is in there, I think. The guy who ends up on Fringe, the last guy in Fringe. You know, my battle. He's one of the names in there. Maybe what's her name? Jean's looking at him. She can point out.
Paul Shockley.
Oh, here's Kate the Great. Where are you, Kate? Have you been listening all this time, or did you go away for a while? You just came in.
Oh, here we go. I've been away. I just came back recently.
Well, you'll want to hear these stories.
And I'm enjoying them. Continue your discussion.
Yeah, we're sorry. For those not interested, we're sorry that I become the focus of conversation, but that usually happens when Ian isn't around. So.
Right, but this is payday. You know, Bob is in charge. I'm in charge, whoever's talking.
Yeah. So look at the video of Ian on Dupes. It's sort of him in his prime. He does a poem or two. And he is remembered. Oh, yeah, so I found out in Toronto in September, when I was there, that he died in April 2012. I did not know that he had died out in British Columbia. So Ian's the one who came up with the number, noticing the 22 in the news. Here's what happened. Okay, so I tell him I'm doing the McLuhan Archives. It's when I'm doing the McLuhan Archives I notice I'm in box 22. So then I tell Ian that, which would have been in December 81. And then he unbeknownst to me, starts making a notebook noticing 22 everywhere. And he comes back to me like in June 82 and shows me this book, little notebook of his poet's notebook, and he says, here, you have this. I can't take it anymore. 22 shows up everywhere. And I'm going, what? Hey, Carol, on the phone, the oven's blinking. So there's that beeping sound. So the...
Thank you. I just was yelling that at Michael.
Yeah.
What is this beep?
You're asking Michael if he's doing it?
Yeah, I'm like yelling at him, like whispering.
Yeah, get rid of that beeping.
Well, I'm pointing at it every time it goes off,
Carol's making her pizza, so that's the signal to her.
See, that's why I ran to check the microwave. That's funny.
Okay, so in June, after 6 months, Ian gives me his notebook and says, look, 22 is everywhere. I can't take it anymore. You deal with it. And he showed me all this interesting newspaper articles, 22 everywhere. So he noticed the 22 pattern after I kind of noticed it just within me, but he noticed it out in the world. And now the McLuhan seminar started up again somewhere around then. And that's when he had
the Hebrews knew a little bit about that a long time before that.
Oh, yeah. But no, we're just noticing it in the Android meme, in the media. So sometime after that, he got mad. He did have a tantrum in 1981. And then he had another tantrum in 82, and that's when he left for Ottawa. I know he got mad at, but he wasn't mad enough to not speak to me, but he got real mad in 82 over something that happened at the new McLuhan seminars, the new ones that were put on by Eric and Derek de Kirchhoff and David O'Driscoll. So, we have a correction there. He couldn't have run away in November 81 because that's when I'm doing the McLuhan thing, and I tell him And then I eventually tell him, maybe that's the day I told him about, no, I wouldn't have done the Box 22 by then. So he hears about Box 22, deals with it for six months. And then maybe that's part of why he ran away.
But it's pretty much Thanksgiving. Does that help at all? No.
I know it's what it is. It's over the McLuhan thing. And November 1881, I know the date I started the McLuhan stuff. So the point is that he freaks out 6 months later. I'm just thinking now, the 22 pattern that I first mentioned to him slightly, it could have freaked him out, and he didn't want to deal with what later became. He didn't want to deal with my scene because the 22 thing freaked him out. So that may be another reason why he ran off to Ottawa. And he comes back 2 years later. And you will hear Ian on the famous, you know, when I get elected Secret Council 10 on March 3rd, 1988, on Mike Dyer's afternoon show, and we're screaming, yelling. Ian's there. He's my bodyguard. You'll hear Ian laughing, yelling in the background. Ian used to come to the CKLN with me in 87, June 87 till April 20th, Hitler's birthday, 88, including the debate with Reverend Stang on April 13th, 1988. That's on the timeline. Ian was the guy who was my bodyguard. So you can hear him in the background making commentary occasionally. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he came back in 1984, and that's when we got on the radio, and so he monitored that from that point on, the whole CKLM thing with Bob Marshall.
Okay, so by bodyguard, you also mean monitor?
Monitor. I mean, it's a joke. We called him my bodyguard. He wasn't my bodyguard, yeah. Literally, but he was big and beefy, and he looked like one. And he could intimidate little punks at CKLN, so he was considered my bodyguard.
Okay. The next one is Paul Shockley, and it's April 3rd, yeah. 1982.
April 3rd, 1982. So Carol and I go up and visit Walter Boward in Port Townsend, Washington State. And while there, we drive down to Portland, Oregon to meet Paul Shockley, who I had met in Seattle in 69-70. He now become the new medium for cosmic awareness, so I wanted to check him out because we looked a bit askance at what his mediumship was as opposed to Dave Worser's channeling of cosmic awareness. So Walter and I drove down to see Paul Shockley in Oregon, and we had some interesting things happen that day. Walter got this big insight that there'd been studies on people, and you trigger the eureka part of your brain, the brain that gets insights. And he was telling me and Paul Shockley that they just discovered that people prefer that insight, the insight, eureka sensation, more than orgasm.
That's
the
great.
Mental orgasm was a stronger thing than the sexual orgasm among these people who had the mental orgasm stimulated.
Wow.
So we were talking about that day at Paul Shockley's home. And Dee Dee Farrell was there, who she just posted the other day. She's the one who distributed the D-cell in the 80s. And so Paul Shockley, what else? We may, that guy, there was a guy there who we met, and I think we went back to his apartment in Seattle on the way back. So anyways, driving down, I was trying to get Walter interested in Dr. Beter. So we were listening to the Dr. Beter tapes on the truck, you know, tape machine. And a couple times we almost died because Boward kept falling asleep listening to Beter and driving off the road and hitting a rail or something. So it was amazing we made it through that. So I stopped playing the Beter tapes after a while because he was only falling asleep. He said, this guy makes me fall asleep.
Wow. Well, that's the next person. It's Dr. Beter. It's April 22nd of that same year, 1982. This is pretty funny how you're basically going into the next person each time.
Right, that's a good point. Yeah, I have forgotten that. So now I know Beter for years, but this is the big, in January 25th, 1982, Al Haig announced something. He became Secretary of State, and remember he had announced he was in charge after Reagan was shot on March 31st or something, 1981, so like about a year before. So Haig was And Dr. Beter's tapes reported that Haig represented the Rockefeller guys trying to fend off the Bolsheviks who'd taken over the Pentagon. So Haig was in a weak position. That's why when Reagan got shot, he tried to take advantage of it. Said, "I'm in charge," and exploited. Mm-hmm. But he probably didn't get far. So he got really pissed off. On January 25th, 82, he said, "We got a real problem. We got nuclear war." He panicked. He made this press conference on that date. So Dr. Beter, on April 22nd, which is one of the most important dates, we were talking, we met and talked about the crisis that was coming, and that's when Beter said, according to his source of information, definitely there was going to be a nuclear war attempt in September 82. So that was an important conversation leading up to us intervening on September 17th in 82. Okay?
Yeah. Except that, what do you mean? September.
You know, I'm just thinking
82.
Now, June 25th. I got to check that. Maybe Haig. No, I think Haig made his statement 6 months before. But go ahead, bud.
You got June 23rd. But that's
No, that's not related to this.
Yeah.
So you can go and read Beter's transcripts of the recordings he made in 1982. That's those, because he's going to quit in November 82. So this is his final year of doing these recordings, which he'd been doing for 7 years. So it's a big year for Beter, and very dramatic. Okay, next date.
Okay, I just finished eating too, so sorry about the delay. So the next one is April 22nd, 1982, Dr. Beter. Then June 23rd, 1982,
Barry Nevitt.
Yep.
I remember that, yeah.
I love that guy.
Beg your pardon?
I love that guy. Surprisingly to me, my favorite quotes from this book, from Fatic Communion, which is where I'm reading the memo from, are from him, yeah. Absolutely from him, yeah.
Yeah. Did you see the interview with him that got posted on my Facebook a couple weeks ago?
Mm-mm. The video? I don't think so.
Yeah, go back and look at that. So on that day, June 23rd, 1982, I go visit him. He's like the main guy to talk to after Marshall died in early 81. So on that day is when I went with Barry, and he appreciated my understanding of McLuhan, and he named me his archivist. And then I started collecting up all the stuff, and I just was looking through. I have the unpublished part of Take the Day, the Executive's Dropout, where they take the 10 Thunders of Finnegan's Wake and lay out advice to management based on the 10 Thunders. It's an incredible thing. And I have that manuscript because I became his archivist. So I got a lot of valuable stuff from him.
Wow. Yeah, I would love to hear more about that, actually, his archives. Then June 15th, 1983, so you're going a full year later,
right.
With
they only go up to about 1984, right? The dates end in 1984.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Specifically only. Yep.
So June 15th, 1983. Who would that be?
Nelson Thal.
Oh, that's the day we met. Well, we actually met in early 83. He and Barry Nevitt started to do the McLuhan Monday Night Seminars, open to the public, that McLuhan used to do. So the coach house was shut down for a couple of years, and it got reopened in early 83. So Nelson and I went and saw De Kirchhoff, who was sort of in charge with David Driscoll of the coach house, and we asked if we could start the Monday night things up. And we said we got Barry Nevitt, who had cachet there, clout, and Barry would be part of it. So now that's in May 83. What happened?
June.
Now, what happened? Oh, wait. So the seminars? No. The seminars started. No, I didn't know Nelson. So I didn't organize that. I didn't do that. I'm thinking of a later thing. So Nelson and Barry Nevitt organized the seminars starting in April, May. So I went to them. And on April 25th, 1983, George Thompson, McLuhan's assistant, who was a good friend of Nelson, introduced me to Nelson. He said, you two, I think, should meet. So I met him, and that was nothing came of that. But then Nelson, and that was a group panel organized by other people. But we met there, and then in May, Barry and Nelson started their Monday night thing. So I went to them, and after one of them, middle of May, I was talking to an older journalist whose wife was a patient of Carolyn's, and he was talking about the Center of Investigative Reporting. He was complaining that investigative reporting had disappeared and journalism couldn't be done the way he liked to do it. So we were talking about media and news and journalism, and I started telling about my bustle. And all these, Skolnick and everybody, I said, there's the real journalism. Why don't you get turned on to that? You know, start doing this. And this guy was a bit of a phony, and I knew he probably wouldn't do anything. But anyways, I'm going on about Mae Brussel and the Kennedy assassination and all this stuff. I'm not saying I was involved in the Kennedy assassination at that point. I wasn't saying stuff like that to nobody. So anyways, I'm talking to this guy and saying a lot. And then the meeting dispersed, because this was a talking after the formal discussion. The meeting dispersed, and Nelson came up to me and says, I heard you talking about Mae Brussel. I know about Mae Brussel and Kennedy assassination. I didn't know you knew this stuff. And I said, oh, yeah. So he said, we got to get together. So we arranged to meet at my place on June 15th, 1983. So he came over. And he was flabbergasted at what I could teach him about McLuhan, but also since he had done research in the Kennedy assassination on his own for years, he actually went to the conference in Boston in 1975, which featured Mae Brussel and Skolnick, among other people, but Nelson was too young to connect with them, but he vaguely remembered them there, but he didn't know anything. If he was born in 1952, so he was 22 when he went to that conference. And so that would have there's a significant date for him. So, but he was amazed that I had all this stuff to say about Mae Brussel. So we got together and talked what we would call bottom-up stuff. That's McLuhan. That's people-generated reality. And then the top-down is the bureaucratic control of society by whoever elites pretend to be bureaucracy. That can go from church to government or military. So we did, and that's top down. So he never had a chance to talk bottom up and top down with McLuhan topics with anybody. And then when he found out that I had talked to McLuhan about that stuff, he said, man, I should have talked to Marshall about, I didn't know Marshall was into the Kennedy assassination and that stuff. So that was the beginning of our friendship, June 15th, 1983.
That's really, really cool. Did you have your charts to do that, or is this kind of how?
No, the charts don't get made till. Well, what happened is he and Bob Marshall made the first chart in 1985, on April 22nd, 1985. And that's on. You can see that at fivebody.com. They took my stuff and made a top-down and a bottom-up chart.
Right. And you said something in Cambridge about a black and white kind of flip happening with that. I don't remember what.
Well, they flip back and forth because the word becomes a market, so the bureaucracy then becomes the authority in the media, and whoever controls the microphone at the White House determines what reality is. They determine whether contact is made with aliens or not, or whether there's such a thing as the iCell. That's the Android meme. That's where the content becomes the form. The content and form merge.
That's
so the medium and the message merge.
Mm-hmm, with the flipping
because
from
the new technology
the
is speech itself. What'd you say?
That's why I'm visually picturing it as like a receding black, kind of phasing in and out of a white.
Right. That's Ion saying it's not whether it's right or wrong or who's right or wrong, it's who is to be blamed.
Or who's got the loudest voice.
Yeah. Who's got the microphone to blame everybody. And so it's important to understand that the software global theater merges and merges and homeopathizes and shrinks to, in the end, the technology that runs the world is speech from the White House. That's the focal human scale of the Android meme. Comes down to a little global membrane. Not a global village or global theater, but a global membrane. And the center, the communication of that radiates from what's called the White House. So that is what date? June 15th, 1983. We finished that.
Then September 10th, 1983 is, little thrill, David E. Worster.
Right. So September 83. Yeah, thrill.
Yeah. Thrill squared is what I like to say now.
Yeah, that's when he's living out in Lake Elsinore in California. You know, you can hear in Furry Lint, he's talking to me about interesting place where all the elites live in Lake Elsinore, and he's living out there.
Michael played a clip for me once of him playing piano. Where is he for that?
That is recorded in 19... That's the day before the Zappa interview. That's October 20th, 1988, in a small bar in Venice Beach, where I wanted to interview Dave, and we do that. And Jerry and Dave knew the bar and organized it, and we got someone to videotape that. And then the next day... we get word that we can do Zappa. So maybe David Worser was 2 days before, October 19th, and then we hear about Zappa on the 20th, then we bring Bob Marshall in on the 21st, and then the interview's done Friday night, the 21st into the 22nd. So, but that's 1988. Back in September 83, I would not be in Dave's presence. I must have had a very important phone call with him when he was in Lake Elsinore, and a lot of talk about whatever. And some of that got recorded then or later, and it's on Furry Lint. And the kind of conversation on Furry Lint is typical of what Dave would talk about. Because the one on Furry Lint is January 86, where Dave says he's going to make 4 chess moves and somebody's going to lose $40 billion because someone stole his dog, and that led to the space...
That's right.
Shadow Challenger goes up on like January 26 or something,
click,
or 28.
Click. Yeah.
So I'm not sure. That's a phone conversation with Dave, and nothing sticks in my mind about what was significant about that. Maybe I was telling him about Larry Flint and Rebel Magazine. Yeah, because Rebel Magazine starts then, and Mae Brussels got a big role in it.
Larry Flint, is that another magazine that he had?
Yeah, he started Rebel Magazine. As he was running for president, he wanted to create an alternative journalism to go against time, and that's after he met Mae Brussels, and it's after the KAL-009 has crashed in the Korean Airlines in September 1st, August 31st or something, 1983, and then Mae calls up Flint. She didn't know him and told him what it really meant. He's flabbergasted what she knows, so he says, I'm going to make a magazine around it, around you. You're going to be the focal point. And shortly after, Mark Cooper and some people came in, maybe even G. Gordon Liddy came in and moved, convinced Flint to not rely on May so much. So that doomed the magazine, and it only went about 8 issues. And then they arrested Flint, and he was put in a mental asylum in Rochester, I think, somewhere in those places.
He also started Transworld.
What's that?
Transworld is a skateboard magazine.
Oh, okay.
But he started that in 83 too, I think. Founded in 1983.
Yeah, what happened is that he had put out a Kennedy expose in the LA Free Press in 1978. As a result of that, he was shot, paralyzed from the leg down, or the waist down, and he was in agony because his nerves were damaged for 5 years. He finally had an operation in 83 that severed the pain nerve, but he lost his sexual function. That was the sacrifice. So he now could function. Now he's pissed off at what Reagan had done to America. So then the KAL-007 goes down, and he's suspicious of that, and he puts a big ad in the newspapers in the first week of September 83 saying, let's question this. It's not what Reagan says it is. And unbeknownst to me, Frank Zappa was working on the big spread on him being in Hustler magazine in the April 84 issue. So Frank walks in, sees this big newspaper ad thing that Larry's working on, gives him advice on how to tweak it. So Frank gets involved with Larry Flint, and Frank's not aware of Mae Brussels. But that ad, that's right, the ad went out. Mae liked the ad, called him up, told him even more stuff about Congressman Larry McDonald, who would have been J.W.'s congressman out of Atlanta, Georgia. But J.W. would have only been, 17 years old then, 18 years old. I had to ask J.W. about Larry McDonald. He was the main Cold Warrior guy. So he's on KAL-007, and he dies. And so May calls up Larry Flynt and says, the gang around Larry McDonald, congressman, whatever he was, senator, probably were the people who shot you in 1978. So she kind of fills in details, and that floors Larry Flynt about how he got shot. May knows these things. And so he turns them, and then they create Rebel Magazine. What else? So then May Brussel does Rebel Magazine. Then I turn Frank on to maybe the last date is, what's the last date in 84? Is it August 84?
But you have one
what's
more.
What's the date,
between
September
there?
21, 83? What's the date after that?
It's the next one is December 29th, 83, Garrett Dean. And then the very last one is August 14th, 84.
Yes, that relates to this. So Garrett, you can hear my phone conversations I recorded with Garrett Dean on Furry Lint. He's very funny, and it's really good stuff, very funny. You ever heard Furry Lint? Who's forgotten Furry Lint? Listen to all those 3 hours and 45 minutes?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Well, you'll hear Garrett being really funny and great, and I'm calling him the Jimmy Joyce. He says he's the Jimmy Joyce, or I'm saying he's the Jimmy Joyce of Dartmouth. That was recorded on December 29th, 83, so that's a significant encounter with,
yeah,
you know,
that's
getting
why
evidence.
I compared him to Tokyo Rose, because I said the way he comes off in that, to me, is like everybody's boyfriend, there to please everyone, you know.
Everybody's boyfriend is there to please everyone? What did you just say?
He's so intimate and congenial and gregarious,
yeah.
that I compared him to Tokyo Rose in an analogy of, I think it was Tiny Note Chart or something on Dupes. I said he was like Tokyo Rose in the fact that he filled whatever needs you had for the women.
Who, my needs?
Garrett Dean. He was, I
he
feel,
filled the needs from the women.
The quintessential ladies' man, in the fact that he, I feel like he came off as he had the ability to intimately relate to anybody.
Yes. So women like that, you're saying?
Yeah. They crave that, is what I think. And
yeah,
then,
that's right.
Yeah. It's all fits and giggles around that guy.
Yeah, women love talking to him. So, and of course, I learned that from him, and that's why I'm a ladies' man today, right? Because of my ability to charm people that I got from my mentor, Garrett Dean. So anyways, and that's listed. He's Holy Office number 9, the personal mentor. So that's important because I recorded him and got him doing good stuff so people could hear it. Then the next date is August 14th, 1984. That's when... Harry Greenbaum, my Zappa connection in New York City, who would send me all the bootlegs, he calls me up and says, Zappa will be, it's like in the afternoon, he will be at the Lamplighter, no, the Limelight on 6th Avenue and West 20th tonight at the club. You got to be here. Now, the building is a church. That was where Thompson ran Lindisfarne in the 70s, right there on the corner of 6th Avenue and West 20th Street. And so I don't think I knew what the Limelight was till I got there. So it was taken over by, Thompson writes about this, how what was a very sacred thing with Gregory Bates and all these mystical New Age thinkers there in the 70s became a raging disco in the 80s run by a Canadian, and they got busted in the 90s, and that led to that famous murder, that kid murdered the other kid. You might have heard those guys of your generation.
What?
Michael somebody.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That happened in Thompson's old haunts. So he was saying that was a metaphor of what happened to America after Reagan came in. They wiped out the eco-fascist stuff that Thompson was running in the nice meditative church there, and then it became a raving disco with a murder in it, you know, 10 years later.
They're trying to, it would be like a underground party, rave, and then they're trying to initiate something in a place that was once holy. They're trying to
doing the modern initiation through
to create a ritual,
youth culture. Yeah.
Wow.
And it was run by a Canadian guy. And Thompson had abandoned the United States in the late 60s and went to Canada and taught there before he came back with his new commune Lindisfarne idea. So Thompson had a Canadian connection too. Okay, so Greenbaum tells me this like at 4 in the afternoon or something. So I grabbed my passport. I said, Carol, I'm running to the airport. I got to get down there, get a plane. There was a plane from Toronto, New York. So I get out to the airport, good time, get in the airplane. I don't even have hardly any money with me. I don't know why. I bought a real quick ticket. And I sit there on the tarmac for an hour and a half because it's stormy and the plane can't fly. So I end up eventually getting to the limelight at 11:30 at night. I was hoping to get there by 9, you know. And so I get in there and I find Henry, and he says, Frank is holding court at the back. So I go back and watch Frank talking to people. And the disco is dancing away. I think most people don't even know Frank's there or don't care because it's like the next generation. And so at a certain point, no one is talking to Frank. So I make myself visible to Frank. And, you know, we've known each other for a long time. So we get right into it. I'm telling him about Rebel Magazine and Mae Brussel, my version of the story. I didn't know he was involved in it, involved in the story. Because this is, he has his spread in the April 84 Hustler, and now this is August. It's almost a year later, you know, from September 83 to August 84. And I don't know, I'm telling him all about what happened to Larry Flynt, because he's somehow connected to Flynt because he's in the magazine. So I tell him about how he got arrested, and he's in a mental institute, and Mae Brussel was the cause of it, blah, blah, blah. And he only dimly gets this. He was aware of what happened to Larry. He knew he ran for president, but he didn't know the Mae Brussel level. So I said, you've got to hear Mae Brussel's recordings. So that's where we organized that I would send him the recordings. And he gave me his agent, Jane Friedman, in New York. I think that was her name. And then we, so that's August 14th, 84. So that was a great night. I'm glad I made it there to make that connection, because he then performs, and he's on tour. He's performing around this time, the summer of 84. He always performs in election year and, you know, stirs up the pot. So he performs in Toronto 2 weeks later. I see him there in Toronto. And then he comes to Halifax, Nova Scotia, November 6th, the day of the election, when Reagan gets in for a second term, November 6th, 84, and Sue Bone and the Club 22 people in Halifax, they're now going to get to see Frank in their hometown, so they say, I got to be there, so they fly me down there. I didn't need the money, but they just make it sort of generous, or just to make sure I get there. And that's where I think we have pictures posted on Dupes where we take Garrett and Sue Bone and Art McKay and Greg Skinner. Greg Skinner's the guy with Harry Whittier, who met me in New York City when I was dancing to the rock and roll in 1975, in April 75. And that was the Ken Kesey story and Paul Krasner. So we get to see Frank in Halifax the next day, and we've heard Sue tell the story. She goes into we drive downtown to go to the mall at Scotia Square. She goes in there, and she comes walking back out with a guy. She says, holy shit, Sue picked up another fucking guy I got to deal with. She's always picking up guys or just friendly being with people and always bringing new people that I want to deal with. So the guy gets in the car, and as he sits in the car, I recognize him. Wait a minute, who's this guy? And I realize, oh, it's Alan Zavod, the guy who played piano for Zappa the night before. So I said, where's Frank staying at? And he said, the Citadel Inn. So he said he'd take us up there and so I could see Frank. So we go up there.
To be clear, this is the 2 weeks later after August 14th, 84?
No, this is November 6th, November 7th, Nelson Thal's birthday, November 7th, 1984.
Okay.
In Halifax. See, August 14th, I've told Frank I'd send the Mae Brussel tapes to him. Now I have a chance to talk to him. Because often when he's on tour, it's hard to get to him. You have to know people to get tickets, you know, and get backstage. Well, I didn't know anybody to get tickets in Halifax. I didn't even know what was happening. But they got tickets. So I always got backstage in New York because of people I knew in New York, like Henry Greenbaum, would get tickets. Because I didn't get tickets because they'd go real fast back then. So anyways, I'm now, next day, November 7th, talking to the piano player, Sue's recognized him and said, hey, come over, I want you to meet somebody. So he says he'll take us up to Citadel Inn. And so I meet John Smothers, the bodyguard, and I explain that I have the Mae Brussels tapes and I need to talk to Frank to see what he thought of them. So he goes in and comes back out and says, yes, Frank's having dinner. He'll be out in a few minutes. So Frank comes out, and we sit there for half an hour, 45 minutes, talking about the Mae Brussels tapes. And Sue is gets a photograph of me and Frank. It's the only photograph of me and him together. And so we had a great time.
Did she share that anywhere online?
No. You know? I don't know where that – I have one somewhere, and she may have someone – she might – be able to show that. Unless she gave me the only one she had, I'm not sure, but I'm sure I have it somewhere. So anyways, the point is that the September 21st, 83, I am telling Dave Wurster about Larry Flynt and Mae Brussels, and I don't know Zappa is involved with Larry Flynt and is involved with the thing that the ad about KL that draws Mae into Flynt's world, creates Rebel Magazine that runs 8 issues. And then Flynt is busted, and then the editorial policy changed at Hustler slightly, so there was a coup maybe at Hustler, so I don't know finally
You've got to check this out, Bob, the Transworld magazine, because it started
No, it's just another magazine. Let me finish the story. So
no,
here it is,
okay.
A year later, August 14th, I'm telling him to do the Mae Brussels thing, and then he says, well, I know a bit about the Larry thing because I put the ad, helped him make the ad. And that was amazing to me. So then that's August 14th. So then November 7th, I'm with him, and we talk about the recordings. And then a year later, say September 85, Frank calls up Mae Brussels and says, I'm going to go testify against the rock censorship lyric stuff, and give me the dirt on the guys who are going to be on the Senate panel. So she does. So then she calls me, tells me, Frank just called me, and I knew it was because of you. And so she appreciated that. And then shortly after that, Frank gave her a computer, which I don't think she ever – that would get into 86, and I don't think she ever did anything with it. And then she died 2 years later. So there's the full story of the dates.
And then we listened to, I don't know, maybe 2 months ago on Payday, Frank going through that, right, the censorship stuff.
Yes, I think he went there September 19th and made his statement. Yeah, we played it, right.
Oh, that was, and he talks about having the unfolding accordion-like paper, and that was great.
He talks about it?
Yeah, because they're asking him, does he go into toy stores, and they're like all trying to put him on the spot. And
yeah, but you're right. But what was your words? Unfolding papers.
He has good comebacks for everything. He has answers for all of their censorship questions.
On the paper, on the
he
paper.
He has solutions, and part of it is to have all the lyrics printed out in an accordion-like paper that folds up and is inserted with the, I guess, audio tape or analog tape at that time. And they're kind of...
Wait a minute. I tuned out. You're saying he had a fold-up bunch of paper at the testimony?
No. He's trying to explain to them what would be a useful way to deal with copyright of lyrics.
Right. Yeah.
And it is what we do now for CDs and analog tapes. But nobody has any idea what he's talking about. He's saying, well, maybe it could be a folded piece of paper.
Right.
And,
you're talking about what he, yes, the folded paper.
Yeah,
right, right.
But he has a good solution to each angle of each person that is on the panel, and that's probably related to getting some understanding through Mae Brussels of how to approach each person.
No, maybe. He deals with the bottom up. He deals with the legal stuff. About how what he knows the industry, he knows how to correct the bureaucratic, distribution of costly censorship stuff. The Mae Brussels is just about who these guys are and the dirt on them. He just wanted to have that to give him confidence that they're all vulnerable in case he needed it.
Oh wow! Okay.
That was just a security blanket. He said, tell me about these guys so I know that I'm superior to them.
Oh, okay.
So Madeline says, we're hearing this history, so we finished it, so people should call in now and start talking. I'll have to start playing music.
right? Be forced. Let's play the Bob Marshall tapes from CKLN.
The Bob Marshall, which one would that be?
I don't know. That's the next thing when he does the...
Play some Bob Marshall?
Yeah, when he dupes Adam Vaughn, right?
Right.
Okay.
There's a whole bunch of stuff there. Robert posted Kuschelman's map. That's mentioned in my manifesto. Kuschelman's map. Kuschelman. I wonder what Robert's looked into that about.
Or the day before the harmonic Bob Virgins. That's hilarious.
Yeah, well, that's... have you heard that?
No. I've only just read these words and thought, what a great, great little term that is.
Yeah, we could... I think that's recorded. We could play... That's me on Mike Dyer. I'll have to see if we have that one. Never really listened to that again.
Well, okay. Right here it says... Mike invited Bob onto his show at the same station, and then it says L-O, ! What does that mean, the L-O?
Oh, low. Zappa used to occasionally write, when he'd write for the mainstream media, he would start an article, low, and it's sort of like a magician, like a Merlin, you know, waving the wand. To me, it's like a wand statement, low, and then the curtain is removed, and you see something. I think that's how I take the word low.
Okay, like
isn't that
low
right,
and behold?
Is that what low is? She doesn't know. What'd you say?
Well, now it looks like laugh out loud written on a computer.
No, but it's just L-O, exclamation
right.
mark. It's not L-O-L.
Right. Wow. So that's basically the end, Bob. That
yes,
is the end of the list.
Right, let's leave it. Let's leave, what is said after the second list? What comes after that?
Okay. August 28th, 1984, Bob Marshall made his first broadcast of the International Connection on CKLN-FM 88.1.
Right, oh, there it is. Yeah, so that's August 14th. 1984, with Zappa at the Limelighter, or at the Limelight. And then, 2 weeks later, the 28th, Bob Marshall makes
his first
broadcast.
Yeah, so we're going, the dates here on my left page is phase one. The dates, the second list is intro to phase two. And then the Bob Marshall broadcast is phase three, it says, beginning phase three.
Right, and I probably told Frank about the fact I got someone to go on the radio and all that. And we were going to play Mae Brussels tapes. That would have been known by then. So I probably told him that on August 14th too, that we were going to be broadcasting Mae Brussels stuff. But he didn't know anything about Mae at that point. So how does it, so you get the second list, and then it says phase three, and then I just say that date, and then there's nothing more?
Oh, no, there's plenty. Okay. Okay. This was the beginning of phase three. Connie and I privately referred to this act as Who's Forgotten Furry Lent. Bob Marshall was Bobby Dean's new role as a journalist and broadcaster. For the next 3 years, Marshall was the figure to prepare the ground for the unveiling of me and my awesome mission. Phase four, Bobby Dean, with the assistance of his friend Art McKay, had quietly rehearsed this new public visibility by giving a lecture on the work of Marshall McLuhan to a small class in Mount St. Vincent University in Halifax on January 6th, 1984.
Right. Now, that's me giving Prince Charles disinformation. Bob Dean is long dead, and a big secret, a murder that we do not want to be exposed, and we're waiting for people to look at the Guffey thing to notice what happened there. Guffey being part two on The Matrix. So I'm now pretending to, what's his name, Prince Charles, that Bobby Dean is still around or something.
Well, and that's phase four. Yeah, the mystery phase.
Yeah, I totally forgot I wrote that. that stuff. Doesn't even make sense. But so then I make a little pattern. Okay,
with the footnote, I love that little pattern. But
yeah,
okay, as you well know,
Charles. I like that. Do I say? I actually say, it's all about me. I say that to him, Prince Charles.
Pretty much constantly, but yes.
No, you said I go, and then phase four, which is about me.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm saying. You're always jabbing at him like that, but here on page 125, you go ahead and say, for the next 3 years, Marshall was the figure to prepare the ground for the unveiling of me and my awesome mission. Yeah.
Right. Now, I never would have said that to him before that, but here it is after 1990, after City Council 10, and I've disbanded it. And I'm gloating at him, telling him what he didn't know. That's why I'm saying that right then. I would never have said that before. Not until the results were in.
Wow. So then
the footnote. What's the footnote say?
Well, there's one more paragraph, and then the footnote.
Okay.
So, as you well know, Charles, in January of 1987, I met with your representatives in London to arrange your purchase of a large quantity of gold bullion.
This is the gold deal with Hugh Sims Hilditch. You know, I've talked about the gold deal with Bitter and Hugh Sims Hilditch, the representative of the Queen. That's what that's about.
Okay. After that, we were ready. This is great. We duped Adam Vaughn, the manager of CKLN at the time, by having Bob Marshall replay some audio tapes by Peter Beter, which Vaughn had forbidden.
Well, the bottom thing on the TV is gone.
Oh, that's what's Kate saying?
Noted.
Ooh, there's somebody in the background. Was that Kate? Mm-hmm. Did Kate just say something, or is she talking to someone else?
It was an echo of Mike Dyer being very upset that Bob Marshall being fired.
Okay, read that sentence again.
Okay. We duped Adam Vaughn, the manager of CKLN at the time, by having Bob Marshall replay some audio tapes by Dr. Beter, which Vaughn had forbidden. Bob Marshall was fired. Mike Dyer was upset. Mike invited Bob onto his show at the same station. Lo, I now had a disincarnate form to stage my campaign for chairmanship of the Secret Council of Ten. It was June 17, 1987, in the middle of the Iran-Contra hearings, and 2 months to the day before the Harmonic Bob Virgins. The world began to feel the effects of decades of planning as momentous change became obvious to everyone. A footnote. To illustrate how the forgotten details in people's lives resonate and are often prophetic, consider these facts. 1. Carolyn Wheeler had a boyfriend before she met Bobby Dean. His name was Bob Dyer. 2. Bobby Dean had a girlfriend before he met Carolyn Wheeler. Her name was Carol Dyer. 3. Bob Dyer, Carol Dyer, and Mike Dyer were not related and never knew each other. Gotta go. Let me know, Bob. Ta-da.
Yeah. So the whole thing got read.
Mm-hmm.
And there I am. I said, plan for decades. I've been planning it for a couple, 20 years or something, but we find out from Ian was planned since 1911.
Mm. Well, and then the whole world began to feel the effects of the decades of planning. As momentous change became
obvious. Hey, wait a
minute.
We got someone here. Look at this. Some Virginia says, this is around the time Carol was my physician. Her office was in your house. Yeah, that's 22 Kenwood. So I wonder who Virginia is. Isn't there a Virginia who lives in the States? Anyways, that's funny. She would have visited 22 Kenwood. One of the first 22s I saw after I found I was in part 22, Box 22 of McLuhan's Archives. Now, we have Rhonda here. Rhonda witnessed a lot of all this stuff in the late 70s. Rhonda was at CKLN. Okay, so what were you – I just had to interrupt you. What was that last point you were making?
Oh, it just kind of rang a trigger of the Malaysia flights and saying that it will, now the world will have to notice, or will have no choice. It will notice. Kind of this.
Do I say that, or what do you?
No, wasn't that what Ion said, that something was going to happen, and that all of them were going to use the same, what was it? The next planes to disappear would all use the same gate, and then the world will have to take notice, or what was
that?
No,
JW said there is one gate that they're all falling into, and over there, you know, Indian Ocean or something.
So what I'm saying is that here we're hearing about the world beginning to feel the effects of decades of planning, and maybe we're at the place where the world can't deny it anymore, and it's just,
I'm just going to go down and see if we have an August Harmonic Convergence Mike Dyer show. In my mind, that is not available, but we'll see. That would be 1987. 87, August 19th, Bob and Michael. Oop, that's after the. So it has to be August 5th. So let's listen to the August 5th show to see if we do the Bob Virgins thing. If this is the,
it's my dad and my brother's birthday.
Okay. All right, so we're. So for this, I'm going to mute people because we don't want the sound happening. But you people, if you want to make this a party, okay, we've heard the main lecture. Now other people can talk. I guess that was a good bunch of stories.
All participants are now unmuted. All participants are now muted.
So sound. See if this works.
A program by Bob. A funny thing about Bob. Bob was stinky and did not take a bath. No!
All falsities, of course. None of this is true. And
nowhere near if Finnegan's awake. But there was something you were mentioning, seeing the prominence of the Subgenius book in all our local bookstores, right even by the cashiers. I mean, that's a sure sign of a cop-out right by the cashiers.
You have your wallet out. You have the image of Bob staring at you. Well, the
word of Bob.
The word of Bob.
Sold.
And you have your wallet, your credit cards there, and you could just, like a magnet.
And you have a pink at the cash.
You feel your money just lifting out of your wallet. You reach for the book. Something draws you to
it. And it wasn't there in, say, May.
No.
It started happening in July once we'd been on the air for a couple of weeks.
The term Subgenius was virtually unknown at the time, and there are some people. We get some phone calls from some devotees who we try to save over the phone.
Yes, they're guided by Reverend Stanley.
Often it's too late, but
Well, that reminds me, there's been a lot of pink action and anti-Bob action at the radio station.
Let's talk about that. I'm a little concerned about my fellow programmers. I know a few have been interested in what we're doing, and
yes, but they want the tapes. They want the address to get the tapes. They miss the whole point.
Exactly.
They don't ask to have me on the air. I mean, to have me on the air is the essence of the church, and keep me on as much as possible. But no, they want. It's amazing the way the conspiracy can control the pink forces and mobilize them immediately when I surface.
Of course, an exception to that is the programmer who follows us at 6 o'clock, and that is Tom Given. And Tom, in fact, has been saved by the Church of the Subgenius by...
I think he should testify.
Perhaps someday we'll have Tom on for a testimonial, maybe a future date.
And the reason he was saved is that he wanted to get the book, and he wanted an address, yes, with a tape address. But in the meantime, his immediate contact with me moved him past that digression immediately, and now he's a happy guy.
Oh, thank goodness that we got jumped over that hurdle.
He's got a lovely family.
He's got a lovely child, and he has, I think he's improved both physically and mentally in the last few weeks.
He certainly has.
He's lost many years. Let's talk a little bit more about that. I think about the pinks and the inflection of the pinks in the radio station.
Yeah, I'm not leaving your segment, Mike.
No.
I mean, unless they act properly. You've got me. I'm working with you. Any of these other guys try to co-op us with these ridiculous tapes with no understanding of Finnegan's Wake, then we will deal with the matter
We'll keep it going, and I'll try to remain my objectivity for as long as I can.
I know it's hard because they're working on you.
Sometimes I break, sometimes I feel, you know, but I'm strong.
Yeah, that wet underwear, ooh.
Any more comments about the election before we break today?
The
election?
Not the public election. That's not an election. The secret campaign to put me into the Council of Ten, which is necessary to prepare us for the Exodus arrival sometime over the imminent eon. Mm-hmm. Just wait for that phone number.
Okay. We'll see you next week.
Yeah.
Praise Bob.
Yeah.